So we just started with the question of, what do you do for fun? And then the guys in Afghanistan were like, well, I ride my motorcycle, I play football, and I play video games. And then the guys in Arizona were like, oh, I play football and I play video games.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Why Distance Learning, the podcast for educators who are engaged with live virtual learning experiences, whether they be content providers who produce and facilitate or educators who want to complement their curriculum and learn more about the medium. We interview content providers, industry professionals, field experts, and educators who love and use live virtual learning. And this week, we have Brandon Furterer, who's the head of programming at Shared Studios, along with Ross Phillips, who is a social studies teacher at Winnaconut High School in Hampton, New Hampshire. Welcome, Brandon and Ross.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yay.
We are super excited to hear about Shared Studios and the way that you've used it at your school, Ross, but let's have Allison introduce you first.
Yay. I'm so excited to be here chatting with you and having this conversation. So a little bit about Ross. He is a social studies teacher in New Hampshire and is passionate about bringing the world into his classroom. He holds a master's degree in education from the University of New Hampshire and focuses on igniting students' curiosity for non-Western history, law, and geography. Ross believes in the power of real-world application and uses his extensive travel experience to enrich his lessons. A world traveler himself, he has explored the rich cultures of Thailand, Cambodia, Vietnam, Egypt, Italy, Iceland, and many more. Through his engaging classes, Ross helps students develop critical thinking skills and fosters a global perspective that prepares them to be informed and engaged citizens. Yay! Welcome, Ross!
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
I'm super excited to hear more about how you are using Shared Studios portals. Brandon, as mentioned, is head of programming at Shared Studios and honors faculty at Arizona State University. He is a writer, performer, storyteller, educator, and expert facilitator with a doctorate in intercultural communications from Arizona State University. He has a range of experiences across the private, education, and not-for-profit sectors, where he has worked to harness new communication technologies to bridge cultural divides through dynamic educational arts programs. He was a featured speaker across the world and has academic and creative works that have been featured in publications such as Critical Studies in Media Communication and The Seventh Wave. He has performed works in the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art, Phoenix Art Museum, the Moth Main Stage, and the Dixon Theater in New York City. Yay! Welcome, Brandon!
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Listening to all of that stuff about myself sounds like I've done so much, and I look around and go, have I really done those things? Yes, I guess I have.
Yes, when I was reading all the words, I'm like, yeah, both of what you're saying and bringing to people across the world just makes me super, super excited to learn from both of you.
Thank you.
I just want to know real quickly what story you told on the moth.
I told a story about a car ride from Boise, Idaho to Elko, Nevada, which is where I'm from, where myself and a friend hit a deer. But the story was really more about gender and addiction and a number of kind of underlying things. But it's a funny and frightening story about hitting a deer and then being followed by the police all the way back to Nevada for another like hour and a half while we may or may not have had narcotics in the car. And so it was one of those coming of age moments and a pivotal moment in my life that, bless that deer. that deer gave its life so that I could retrieve mine. So
let's talk about education.
Let's do that.
So can you just start off quickly? Just tell us what is Shared Studios for those people who don't know it.
Yeah. So I think Shared Studios is probably most known for our immersive portals, which are repurposed shipping containers equipped with audiovisual technology. When you step inside, you're in a full body face-to-face conversation with someone in a similar container in one of 20 to 25 countries around the world. I would say that we're a bit more than that. We're more than the portal. I would say that we're actually a network of people. There are trained facilitators on the ground in each of these communities who work directly with their communities to source all sorts of incredible human beings to come and interact with students and with educators. And that might be from a community activist all the way to, you know, a political leader, folks working at the UN, to somebody who's using the internet to create action in their communities. So, you know, the portal is one way in which we deliver that network of people to the world. But I would say we're first and foremost a programming company that creates education-based programming that can be engaged through the immersive environment of the portal or through video conferencing as well.
And so we have one of those people in your network here with us today, and we do want to hear from him. You mentioned a question at the top of when we were just chatting before that I'd love you to answer first, which is how is this different from video conferencing? You posed that question yourself, but I'd love to hear your answer to that question.
So my background is in communication, intercultural being part of that, but in general, communication, about 65 to 75% of any message's meaning is communicated nonverbally. And so when we lose those nonverbal cues, I think all of us have been in sort of text-based internet fights or even text-based, you know, fights with our partners because those nonverbal cues are so important to understanding what folks are actually trying to communicate. That gets, you know, solved a bit when we pull ourselves into a video conferencing environment because we can now see folks face to face. But the reality is we spend a great deal of our time in video conferencing environments self-monitoring. It's really why folks have what they call Zoom fatigue. We spend less time actually interacting and connecting with people than we do monitoring whether or not we look like we're connecting with people. and we're not getting all of the nonverbals that we might get. Now, probably the most important part of our body for nonverbal expression is the face. And it's the one that is universal across all cultures. But the reality is that we're missing all sorts of other nonverbal cues in a video conferencing environment. I always say that I think video conferencing has been really great for connecting us. It has not been so good at creating connection between us. And so it is finding ways in which we can provide a full body immersive experience that allows people to feel like they are sitting across from one another. It creates a certain amount of accountability to your conversational partner. I think that's a huge one. And we really need that accountability and that connection if we're going to build empathy. And empathy is really the building block for being a global citizen and for being able to solve some of the what I would call wicked problems facing the globe today. So I think that I don't want to fully dismiss video conferencing. I think it's been wonderful. And I think it's created so many opportunities for students and educators to engage. But I think it's just one tool in the toolbox. And if we really want to create empathy and connection, we need to either create a face-to-face environment or an environment that mimics it in such a way that it creates that accountability and that level of connection.
Yeah, it's interesting because we talk a lot about utilizing this technology to create connections between people. It's one of the great advantages that you're creating connections with people that you wouldn't otherwise have the opportunity to do so with. We talk a lot about it being a tool and therefore needing to be skilled at using the tool in order to create those connections. I love the idea of not having your self view. That's something that I practice with Zoom because I find, like everyone, I find myself, you know, my eyes drifting into onto that square. And I also, you know, I completely notice when other people are doing it too, right? Because they like sort of look at you when you're talking and then they look at themselves when they're talking. And it's like kind of obvious, right? But I like the minimizing of the self-view or not having that available in the portal as being a huge part of it. The full body language is also really nice. Like I actually just made a motion with my hands that you could not see. Harold, put it up here. It was like this. It was like full body. You know, I was like using my hands to express the gravity of the full body, and you didn't get that, right? Because you've got my bust right now, and that's it. But uh, but I love the idea of those like thoughtful adjustments, and that the purpose of this is to make connections between people. And I'd love to toss it to Ross. How have you used this tool to make connections between the students at your school and people throughout the world?
Yeah, it's been remarkable because, like Brandon said, it's a video conferencing tool, but the power is the connection. So when we connect to some of the sites, I've got, you know, 7-8 years of records connecting with Mexico City, and some of the staff who I started the program, you know, working with are still there. And so when we jump in, there's, you know, 8 years of history. And even now students have that same experience where they're able to be like, recognize the curators by name, recognize them by their demeanor, and be like, how's your pet? Did you get a new tattoo? You know, what have you been doing lately? Did your water get turned back on? And they're able to address these issues that are, one, incredibly personal to the people on both ends, but two, when we reference them outside of like the specific class that was in there, you know, kids are like, oh, I remember talking to the team in Kigali or the team in Mexico City or the team in Iraq. And it creates this different element. And the other thing that's great is, you know, the same way a teacher in the classroom will kind of walk around the room and make sure kids are engaged and pull the kids in, you can see that. Like when a guest is in the back row, whether it's a student or whether who's there, if they're like slouched back and they're not there, it's obvious. And this team does a great job of getting those kids involved. You know, they're not doing it embarrassingly or hostily or anything like that, but it's, you know, are you feeling okay? Like the personal connection is coming through with every site that we work with.
And so you're painting a picture here where it seems like there's a facilitator on each end, right? Are you the facilitator for your location?
Yeah, I am. I initially just was kind of the go-between. And then a couple of years ago, I started, you know, being able and working directly with the team and at Shared Studios to set up the connections and organize everything on our end.
And so what do you see is the main characteristics of your role, right? What do you bring as the facilitator to this experience?
At the beginning, the space for some people is kind of daunting. You know, it, like Brandon said, the walls are blacked out and it forces an attention that for a lot of students is challenging. The idea that there's, you know, if you go into a classroom, there's posters on the wall, there's flags, there's art, there's ways teachers personalize it. And in the portal, there's the people. And so one of the things that's really big at the beginning is getting kids kind of accustomed to the space. But as a teacher who's used it a lot, both with my classes and other settings here, once we get past that, like I have the easiest job in the world because the curators on the other end ask questions and the kids get invested and they just end up going in these conversations and hitting topics that you would never dream of, but all provide something incredibly valuable.
And so how many students are in the portal with you? And is the screen, is it on the short end of the shipping container? Is it on the long end? Like, what does it look like?
So it's on the short end. And it's, we have an inflatable. So we put this big gold room in the library and blow it up and have the screen in it to mimic what the other sites have in a shipping container. So we can fit 6 or so high school students in there at a time.
Got it. And so part of your role as a facilitator, you're talking about like the kid in the back or whatever. Mm-hmm. Those 6 people, that's a big conversation, right? That's like a round table mm-hmm. kind of conversation. So do you find yourself as facilitator, you're really needing to kind of help navigate like whose turn it is to speak and stuff like that? Or does it eventually become more organic?
It eventually becomes very organic. And you know, when we've brought it to some other sites that I've helped out with too, for a high school group, 6 is a really good number, because you can have a couple kids kind of take the lead and be the liaison between the, you know, somebody who's a little quieter or ask some of the tougher questions that, you know, once you get accustomed to who's there and who's talking, you know, then you can really broach some of these very personal and very difficult conversations that you hope happen.
What are some of the toughest questions you've heard kids ask?
We've We've done a lot of connections over the years with Kigali. So in New Hampshire, one of the state standards is that we have to discuss and teach the students issues surrounding genocide. And we tackle that here in our freshman non-Western history class. All the students here learn about Rwanda and the Rwandan genocide. And so talking to people who their parents lived through it, or in some cases they lived through it, and, you know, making sure, you know, some uncomfortable moments have popped up, but, you know, the kids have always come out with a really, really good understanding, especially of how do you move on from an event like that? And to put 14, 15, 16 year olds in a conversation with somebody who survived something as traumatic and life altering as that, gives them such a unique opportunity and perspective of understanding.
Yeah, it's such a powerful opportunity for learning. And I appreciate you sharing that specific example and a little bit more about the setup. Like you said, for the students, it's a really exciting experience for them to connect and learn in that firsthand way and to have you as a support. I also think when you said earlier about the idea that you're really about connection, you're a network of people. In your stories, you're really talking about that network within that insular way within your school, as well as with you and the curator and the shared studio team. So all of that support is, you know, thinking of that from a student's perspective, you know, that must just allow them to break down so many different walls. And when I learned about shared studios, I feel like I've always been really into tech. So Brandon, to your point, I was always like, this is the future beyond. This is beyond the video conference. Like, what's after this? This is the building block. This is how we can bring so many different opportunities and tools together to create and change a different way of thinking about education or thinking about connection, like you said. So to hear just that perspective from you, Ross, of the students and just how it works in that logistical way, as well as that impactful way for the students, is just such gives such a whole bigger picture for me. I do wonder if we can talk a little bit, because I feel like that idea of connection and what you just explained with your students really does kind of go back to the origin and the reason Shared Studios was created. So I wonder if we could talk a little bit or hear a little bit about the story or journey of Shared Studios from starting as I believe it was in a project, an art experience that turned into more of a technology and then business.
Yeah. And I actually think it's a good moment for that question, because I think that that journey kind of pulls in what's at the heart of creating this connection, which is, yes, the immersive experience that allows for the type of embodied learning that Ross is talking about. But it's also about the network of people and how we've come to engage that network of people in education. So you're right. It started as an art project. Excuse me. The founder, Amar Bakshi, was really interested in how he might be able to connect his grandmother to her native Pakistan. He had been a reporter and had spent a lot of time reporting from faraway places. And he found that the conversations that he remembered the most or that were most valuable to him were not the ones he was having during interviews, but rather were the ones he was having with random people on a bus or sitting in a cafe. And he wanted to bring that experience to his grandmother, that she could share a chai with someone in a cafe in Pakistan and feel like she was at home. So he started building this in his backyard, which didn't go over very well in the DC suburbs. And at one point the FBI was called. Why is this person got a shipping container in his backyard? What is he building back there? But the very first portals were at an art gallery here in New York and one in Tehran, in Iran. And I think that everybody knew that, you know, following the contact hypothesis, just actually engaging with someone that you might otherwise never get a chance to meet is a meaningful experience. But I don't think everyone realized just how meaningful it was going to be. And I think this is where that accountability to and connection that's created in that full body environment becomes important, is women on the Iranian side came in, and because the door was closed, they danced, something they're not allowed to do. A young man in Iran came in and actually came out of the closet as gay the folks in New York. And so there were all of these little moments that happened, and it was kind of like an aha moment for Amar, where he was, you know, something interesting is happening here. I'm really happy to be here with Ross because Ross and another one of our partners, Steve Canosi, really started utilizing the portal in education. And when I finished my dissertation, I was brought on to really continue that. I came in permanently right as the pandemic hit. And that, of course, people don't want to be in the intimate space of the portal with five other people, you know, during the pandemic. And so we had to pivot, and we pivoted, and this is why I will never completely discredit video conferencing. We pivoted just like the rest of the world to video conferencing, and it became very clear that the magic that we had here was, yes, there are lots of schools who may have the money to bring this container to their school and give their students the immersive experience that it provides. There are also lots of schools who may not have that money, but really, we can still give them that experience. And so I spent the entirety of the pandemic really working on, one, what is it that we're actually doing here and why is it meaningful? And again, that is the people and the types of stories that they can bring to students in the classroom. And two, how are we facilitating those conversations in a way that actually creates learning outcomes? And so we kind of developed a specific facilitation style and a guide for all of our partners around the world. I started working with my team on creating learning materials. So it might be helpful. The programming can be, you know, somebody like Ross, a teacher at a school, kind of taking control, which he does. So he'll really control the curriculum working in partnership with the folks on the ground in other communities. But a lot of times teachers don't have that kind of time. And so I'll work with my team to create learning materials that we then share with teachers. Their students prepare. There's a set of questions and the facilitators on the other side are prepared to ask those questions and engage those students. Or we might even send a member of our own team to a school to be the facilitator on the school side as well to help facilitate that. So it started as an art project. I think at the heart of it, it's really about the community and connection. The portal is a way to deliver that in the most authentic way possible, but it's really putting young folks into conversation with people different than themselves in a way that creates connection as opposed to just connect them to something through, you know, as they would through another medium.
And so, I mean, that sounds amazing. And I love the origin story. Thank you for asking that question, Allison. In my work at Banyan Global Learning, we have teachers in America and we teach students in Asia. Our last podcast episode was with one of the facilitators on that end. We ended up getting really deep into discussions of culture and how to prepare different cultures to engage with each other, because it's all well and nice until you start running into some values differences. And maybe those values differences might be betrayed in some behaviors that people might think are rude, whereas other people don't. Maybe it gets into some like real deep stuff that is like political. How do you prepare? And this, I guess, a question for either of you. I'm actually interested in what each of you have to say, both from the Shared Studios perspective and from the teacher on site perspective. How do you prepare students to have a conversation with students from our people from other cultures in a way that is going to sort of operate within the box of respectability, but also push the boundaries of what they are able to experience in their own world?
I'll start, and then Ross, I'm actually really interested in hearing this from your perspective as well. You know, as part of our learning guides, we put together a set of shared understandings. This is a space where, and so there's kind of a set of, I'm very much connected to what's called the Mejla style of dialogue or debate, which is, it's kind of born out of Arab cultures in the Middle East, but it's people coming together around a circle to address issues of common concern. And there is a certain set of rules in that engagement that have to do with equity in the times people speak, how people are paying attention to one another, the type of critical active listening that is necessary to actually solve issues. So there's a set of kind of shared understandings that we create. I think what makes this experience great is that if a kid in the US is talking to somebody who has survived the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi in Rwanda and says something that in any other context may be offensive, because we work directly with those communities, they know that not everybody has the same context and understanding or cultural background as they do. They're not going to get offended in that moment. They're going to use it as a moment to actually teach and learn. And I think that's what, I guess I keep bringing it back to these communities, because I really do think they're the most important part of the work that we do, is that they help us create a space where kids can trip up. And it's okay if they trip up. And it leads to it creates an opportunity for us to have a conversation. There's also in the immersive space of the portal, I find, and this is where Ross, I'd be really interested in hearing from you, I find that it tends to be less likely that students will engage in behaviors that are problematic because they feel really accountable as if they're in the same room with that person. There's still going to be cultural differences that may create misunderstandings. That's not necessarily going to go away. But that there's that accountability, but there's also, because it's still mediated by a screen, a distance that allows people to feel comfortable in their own kind of space and culture. So that's a long way of saying that. Ross, I would be really also interested in hearing what you have to say about that.
We've definitely had some kids inadvertently cross that line. And I think that's the key piece of it. And I think that's one of the things that makes the community in this so invaluable, is that people who are coming into the portal have a vested interest and a desire to be there. So if something happens where a kid asks a question that it culturally is inappropriate or is insensitive to the moment, it's never a malicious thing. It's not like an attention grabbing thing, because that space, again, creates a different sort of standard of behavior for the students. But just in terms of the response, like, it's, they see it as a teachable moment. And so my kind of guidance to the students is, any question that you would feel comfortable answering if you were in their situations is an appropriate question to ask. And that has, I think I've had, I don't know how many connections I've done over the years. I should have counted, I guess. But I think I've had one incident where afterwards I pulled a kid aside and I was like, what were you thinking when you asked that question? And we had a very candid chat about, a better way to ask it potentially, or a follow-up that could have been done. But, the community want to be there to help understand, the world and make these connections and see a perspective. So I think when, these issues have come up, it's always been, at the end of the day, when we're debriefing and talking about it as a school or as a community after, it's like, it's always been a positive. Even when it's been uncomfortable at the end of it, the kids have always come out significantly better off for having some of those conversations.
For them to have that learning experience, it's just that real life application. It's the what could happen, and preparing them for any situation that they could walk into, whether that's in a professional life, which, if we think about what does the future look like and we think about the growing technologies, and where does even something like the portal take you next? It's so exciting to think about, but how do you best prepare individuals to have, like we mentioned before, that empathy, to have that global perspective? And when you can really, within the context of your school, turn a knob or walk into a space, and this is where you can have those moments that you might have only had because you went and traveled, or because you found yourself in a conversation or an interaction that maybe was just what life handed you. It just provides such a deeper and more meaningful experience for your learners, which is just so, it makes me so happy. I'm trying to keep my excitement in, which was usually what happens on this podcast. I'm like, I'm so excited. But just to think, especially for the students that are going to be able to connect globally, to create awareness, to continue to strengthen their skills, to have those conversations with each other and continue to have those global conversations, it just makes me feel excited for the future, for the learners that get to participate.
And I think it's important to say it's not perfect, right?
Right.
in fact, this is something, I'm really grateful for this question because it's something that I've been thinking a lot about as we're preparing to go into two very different schools in the next month. One that we have operated in, they bring a portal every year. It's part of this event they do called Empathy Week in the UK. And these are kids who come from a very privileged background. And it's often a challenge, not that they're saying things that are offensive, but that they kind of clam up. And I think, so for me, that's why the facilitators are so important, is how are the facilitators really working to find ways for them to create that connection and to mediate when things may get sticky. But it's also, I've been thinking a lot about how are we, again, even better preparing students. So one of the things I'm working on right now as part of our initial learning guides is really outlining the difference between cultural relativism and universalism, and that we have to understand that while we may not agree with some things, we can't create a sort of cultural universalism. This actually came up in a conversation where we were in this global call, and this woman I was working with at the time asked everybody to say their name and their pronouns, which is her trying to be, you know, inclusive. And as somebody who cares about those things myself, I welcome that. But we're talking to some folks in Iraq and someone in a refugee camp in Uganda, and they don't have the same interaction and experience as we do with conversations around gender, which doesn't mean that they shouldn't have those. But what ended up happening is they didn't really understand what the question was. And then they felt stupid as a result of it. And so I think it's important for us to have those conversations with students first. But I do appreciate that because, as Ross said, the network of people want to be there. They know that there might be awkward moments, and they use those as opportunities to learn. And for me, Allison, to your point, is we need those moments in order for us to actually grow into competent cross-cultural communicators.
Yeah, and especially when you were talking about high school students, having taught high school, in some cases, you really, when you want them to engage or kind of break down the wall, you do need that level of, you know, how is this going to help them grow in the future? They need to almost see it. And when that intrinsic moment's just happening, that conversation, like you're in the same room, it just authenticates the learning experience in a way that is irreplaceable. And as a, you know, video conferencing / digital tools of all way lover, it's that immersive element. How can you take it further without subtracting or depending on a trend? It's really just about making sure you can have that conversation in the most authentic way possible.
I want to kind of restate, pull all everything that you guys said together, because there's some really awesome answers there. You know, the question again is like, how do you prepare students to have these like cross-cultural conversations? And I heard a lot of things. One of them was the role of the facilitator. That facilitator both preparing them beforehand by creating an expectation that this is going to be a place where there could be some things that are said that you might feel are offensive, but are presented in good faith. Right. So that's a critical part of it. There's the immersive experience that Allison was just talking about of the portal itself. There's an immediacy to the design of the portal that makes you feel present and accountable for your own behavior. And that might be like a self-censoring thing. And then there's also this idea that the students are kind of self-selecting themselves. These are people who are interested in other cultures, and therefore they are bringing that good faith to these conversations. And I'm wondering if you guys have any insight about how to reach the people who are not self-selecting themselves for this experience, right? If there's something like, do you have experience where you've essentially converted someone from being uninterested in an experience like this to becoming interested, or have you found there are things that you can say things that can be illustrated with this tool that can bring those other people into this camp of curiosity?
Just to kind of put it in perspective, at Winneconnet, we have around 1,200 students here, And there have been times where we've run a week's worth of connections, and numerically, we've had every single student in the school go through the portal. So we've had everything from kids who skip six classes. My principal, I hope he doesn't listen, who'll skip all of their classes to show up. And we've had kids who, you know, we have to, you know, beg, borrow, and steal effectively to get them to go in. So, but I think the thing that makes it engaging to get even some of those really reluctant students is that every connection on my end, I always set it up with the students, whether it's mine or another teacher, with like, okay, what's the objective? And we outline it, whether it's a conversation about food, whether we had, you know, Spanish language students talking to Mexico City about unknown artists one time. So sometimes I get really specific. Sometimes it's just like the culture, you know, immigration, these big broad ideas. But once a group gets in there, I think, you know, you let them steer the conversation. And so sometimes it stays very, very much on topic. And then other times it wanders a little bit. And that's where, you know, on our end as a facilitator and on the other end, you kind of massage some of those questions to tie in, you know, okay, if we're talking about migration and immigration, and all of a sudden they're like, well, what about TikTok? Do you have TikTok? And it's like, okay, how do you use that as a tool? And you start kind of blending the kids' interests into the way the conversation's going. And once you kind of connect a couple dots that way, they usually buy right in.
I'm so happy I let you go first, Ross, because you teed me right up, which is those reluctant kids are often reluctant because they don't think that they have anything in common with the people they're speaking to. And if you go in saying, we're going to talk to some folks who survived the 1994 genocide against the Tutsis, and some kids are like, I don't even know who that is. I don't know where that is. I don't know, you know, that sounds like something heavy. Yes, we might get to that, but let's just go in and meet somebody first. I'll never forget, and this was with a college student, but we had a portal up at Arizona State University as part of a student welcome weekend. And this also points to kind of things that could get offensive as well. So these young men come in, and we were connected at the time. We had a portal in Herat, Afghanistan. And these young men on the Arizona State side come in, and I'm like, hey, do you want to come in? We're having a conversation with some guys in Herat, Afghanistan. And the guy in Arizona goes, they have internet? And I was like, yes, they have internet. It's a global world. Like, internet exists in other places around the world. But please come on in. And I knew that I wasn't going to get a conversation there that was going to be, you know, an in-depth conversation about U.S.-Afghan relations. But I still saw it as a moment to create connection. And so we just started with the question of, what do you do for fun? And then the guys in Afghanistan were like, well, I ride my motorcycle, I play football, and I play video games. And then the guys in Arizona were like, oh, I play football and I play video games. And that there was this moment where these guys on the Arizona side suddenly were like, we play video games. In my head, I'm thinking it's a 20-year-old, you know, dude. No matter where you are, he probably plays video games, right? So, but for them, it was suddenly this moment of like, oh, we have something in common here. Those guys ended up staying in the portal for 45 minutes, and the conversation ended with, how do the guys in Herat feel about, at the time, the U.S. presence? Did they want the U.S. to leave? Did they want them to stay? You know, what would they ask of the U.S. if they were going to stay? So it started from, and I've written about this, that it's this moment of shared connection, like bonding over something as arbitrary as video games or ice cream, that suddenly becomes this larger conversation that works as an avenue into these deeper topics. So I often don't bring students into the environment and just immediately think we're going to dive into the climate crisis. the world's coming to an end. Instead, it's how do we find moments to connect them around anything? That then creates an opening for these larger conversations to happen.
And at that time in your life, it's essential because you're really in that moving in between that time where you're thinking outside of just yourself. Like you said, it's a global world. And this idea that, you know, how does the world operate where you're not at the center of it, and being able to just extend thought, it provides something for those students. Even if you can think of a video game, every time, hopefully they go back to that video game, they think, oh my goodness, this taught me this and this, or I had that connection. And even that ripple effect by sharing that story helps to show that opportunity to form global connections to others.
Yeah. Gosh. What a powerful story. I mean, we ask for golden moments here, people telling their stories about what makes distance learning so amazing. And we've got like a dozen from you guys here. I do want to ask our other question, which is quite simply, why distance learning? Why does this medium matter?
So as a teacher, one of the big things that we're always trying to do is to prepare our students for whatever is going to come next. And I think there's no, you know, just speaking to the story that Brandon just went through, there's no corner of the world that can't be reached with an ease that we've never seen before. And so I think when you have an opportunity and an ability to connect students, especially in a network of curators and staff and guests where the kids are going to, I've never walked away from a connection being like, well, that didn't go well. Like there's always a nugget, a moment that you can key in on to be like, that was fantastic. You know, I'll replicate it, tell my kids about it, however it is. So I think by putting them in an environment to talk to incredibly diverse people about any topic imaginable. I mean, you know, we keep talking about the network, but I've never reached out to Shared Studios for a connection for my students. And they've been like, we don't know somebody who can do that. They're always like, talk to this person, go to this site. Like, this is who you want to set up with. You know, that distance, bridging that gap is just so incredibly seamless with the Shared Studios and with the connections. And so I think that's why distance learning in particular with Shared Studios has been so pivotal for our school and our students.
And I'll say, you know, I mean, any educator right now knows that, like, got to create global competencies for our students. You know, it's an increasingly global world. I think there were so many promises of the internet, and a lot of those promises didn't come to fruition because the internet started to work to further polarize and divide us as opposed to bring us together. And I think that we have to create these global citizens if we're going to solve the kind of intractable problems that this generation is going to be facing. And the reality is that those problems are so interconnected, whether it be climate crisis, refugees, global poverty and hunger, genocide, all of those things are so interconnected that it's not going to be one nation or one group of people who are going to solve it. It's going to have to take folks working together across cultures to meet those challenges in the future. And so we have to find ways to put young people into conversation with people who are different than them, with people who are like them. And, you know, distance learning is the way that we do that. If we can do it in a way that is immersive and full body and creates empathy while simultaneously helping folks work together to solve those challenges, I think we get some icing on a cake. But really, any sort of distance learning that allows us to engage folks is one step towards actually creating the future that we want these young people to have.
Preach.
Yes. I'm like, let's make the cake. Let's get the icing too. Let's do it.
Oh, amazing. Wow. What an inspiring conversation. Thank you to both of you for coming on the podcast today. We really appreciate your time and have such profound respect, admiration, appreciation, and gratitude for the work you are doing.
Yes. And make sure to check the links because we'll have all of the links so you can check out what all of the environments look like. You can find maybe the environment that works works for your space, your community, your school. We'll have all of that in the show notes.
And that will be on CILC.org/podcast.
Awesome.
If you want to support the podcast, please tell a friend, follow it, rate it, or leave us a review. Thank you, as always, to our editor, Lucas Salazar. And if you want to know the answer to why distance learning, please check out the people we highlight on this podcast. These are the people who are leveraging this amazing technology to truly transform the learning experience. Why distance learning? Because it's accessible and it's awesome. See you next time.
Bye.